Screw this. Wriggling, making herself as slippery as possible, she slid downward in his grip and right out of her cloak. The guy's hold on her faltered. He grabbed for the cloak's slick fabric and she stumbled away. More by instinct than thought, she turned and let off a starburst of stored energy, a flash that blasted outward, thunder echoing on stone. The ace flinched back, sheltering his eyes with an arm as he tossed the cloak away. Her blast didn't kill him, but it seemed to have blinded him. The other agent still wasn't engaging. Ray was picking himself up off the pavement, rubbing his head, and snarling with rage. Ray, Joanne warned. Fuck this, I've got it. He growled and jumped. The big man made a fist and swung around to punch Ray, but the white-garbed ace was already out of the way and coming down on top of the giant's head, hooking an arm around his neck, twisting, and landing a punch on the guy's face. Chips of stone flew from his head. Wait, stone? The other Czech agent shouted a word of denial and ran for them. Joanne held out a hand in a stop gesture. The guy stopped. They both turned back to watch. The big man blinked in confusion. Ray had done damage. A series of cracks radiated across his face, starting at his cheek and looping around his eye, then across a marking on his forehead, some kind of scar or tattoo. He reached up, scratching at it, and another bit of stone chipped away, and the symbol fell apart. The man froze, still as a statue. Just like a statue. The cracks in his face widened, the damage increasing, spreading across his entire body until the whole figure fell into rubble, leaving his coat and clothing slumped on top of it. A weird silence settled over them, confused and watchful. Joanne knelt by the remains, the pile of stone and sand, tracing her fingers through it. Blinking in confusion, Ray crouched where he'd fallen when the giant disintegrated. What was going on here? The remaining Czech agent's expression hardened, grief turning impassive. Finally, he said,
"It doesn't matter. I can make another one. And another."
He was the ace, not his hulking partner. His power, bringing to life stone, making stone men. Joanne's eyes widened. "You're Jewish. That's where your power comes from. Your ace, it draws on the golem folklore."
"I'm a good communist,"
he said, straightforward, like he was used to saying it dutifully over and over again.
"I and my servants are good agents, and I will still find out what you have planned."
Joanne sighed with frustration.
"We don't have anything planned."
"I know you are conspiring with the foreign demonstrators to provoke civil unrest."
She couldn't help it. She chuckled.
"You've got it all backwards. I was just..."
She shook her head, let it go. Clenching her fist, she felt a crackle of power. She could drop him where he stood, with a touch, if she needed to. He was human and had a normal flow of energy through a conventional nervous system, not like his stone servant. But she didn't, because he wasn't doing anything but standing there. Brushing off her hands, she went to retrieve her cloak. With a practiced twist and sweep, she draped her cloak around herself and drew her power close.
"Joanne, you okay?"
Ray was back on his feet, bruised, a trickle of blood dripping down his forehead, but otherwise none the worse for wear. She wondered if she should tell him about the blood before it dripped on his suit.
"Yeah, I'm fine,"
she said. Her ribs felt bruised, but she'd recover. She regarded the Czech agent.
"I'm honestly not here to cause any trouble. We can both walk away and neither of us has to report this." "You have all the power here. You can decide what we do."
He lifted his chin in pride and defiance. He expected them to kill him,
He would have, if the roles were reversed. All she had to do was lift her hand, or say the word and Ray would knock the guy's head off. "Ray, let's go," Joanne said, settling her cloak more firmly over her shoulders and starting away. "We've wasted enough time."
"You're sure?"
Ray said. "Yeah." Together they walked to the next intersection. When she looked over her shoulder, the check agent was gone. A mental clock was ticking. Had Katrina gotten in trouble yet? How close was she to getting arrested? This late, traffic was minimal, but they must have passed a dozen police cars along the way. Joanne thought for sure they'd get stopped. She had the dark surface of her cloak turned out and could be inconspicuous, but Ray's white suit gleamed like a beacon. The police seemed to be on a mission, driving fast, heading in similar directions. It didn't bode well. Joanne hurried and Ray trailed, keeping a lookout. Joanne heard laughter and shouting voices as the broad thoroughfare of the square opened before her. Finally, she spotted them. A gang of young people, teenagers on up to punks in their mid-20s, ran across the street several blocks ahead, laughing and carrying on in a tangled mob. She might have spotted Katrina's peasant skirt, sweater, and writhing Joker limb, but she wasn't sure. It might have been someone else's scarf. The group certainly looked like the kids from the basement. Joanne ran to catch up with them, but they had a head start and no intention of waiting around. Whatever they'd planned, they'd done it, and they'd been successful, and now they were out of here. They pelted down the street, around a distant corner, and out of sight. Not seeing much use in chasing them further, Joanne slowed, stopped, and turned to look up the thoroughfare to the heart of Wenceslas Square and the equestrian statue of King Wenceslas that occupied its center. The statue was covered in flowers, draped with blankets of them on the horse's flank and neck, garlands around its head, ropes of them around mounted King Wenceslas, spiraling up his spear, hanging off the end of it like a banner. More flowers, spares and strays, lay scattered across the shrubbery around the statue, and a few draped in the trees across the street. The acres of paper flowers were what they'd been making in their basement arts and crafts session. They'd transformed the monument into a whimsical garden, springing up in the middle of the city. Along with the flowers, the kids had posted banners, signs, posters, tying them in the trees, taping them to storefronts, plastering them to the statue's base. Symbols, cartoons, slogans, most of them in Czech, which Joanne couldn't read. Some in German, some in English, none in Russian. Pro-democracy, pro-peace slogans. There were drawings of tanks and bombs with red cross-out symbols over them. Peace signs, lyrics from songs, and so on. Katrina's beautiful charcoal drawing was among them, destined to be rained on, torn up, and trashed. Joanne almost wanted to rescue it, carefully roll it up and save it. But no, it belonged here. And this was their protest. No marching, no shouting, no disruption. Nothing blown up, no one set on fire. Dawn would come, and the city's residents, police, Soviet occupiers, and photojournalists would see a bright, colorful work of art full of energy and hope. "That's it?" Ray declared, coming up to stand next to Joanne. "That's their big protest demonstration, what's it?"
"That's it,"
Joanne said, chuckling. "It's pretty, don't you think?" Ray regarded the scene, expression pursed in confusion, scratching his short hair.
"I guess. Don't know that I'd call it art or anything."
She looked at him. "Billy, you wouldn't know art if it smacked you upside the head and bought you dinner."
"Joanne, That almost sounds like you're asking me on a date.
It was one of those moments when gravity seemed to shift slightly. Or maybe the oxygen content of the atmosphere suddenly changed, making her lightheaded. She could say yes, she realized. She could ask the man to dinner, and it wouldn't go anywhere. It wouldn't mean anything. There'd be no point to it. Except what if there was a point? She could have said yes. She could have said no. But she didn't say anything. Just stood there looking at him like an idiot. And he was looking back at her with similar bemusement. Then he leaned in. He was like a kid inching his way to the very edge of a cliff, peering over, seeing how far he could get without tumbling to his death. Maybe convinced that even if he fell, he couldn't possibly get hurt. Well, this was Billy Ray, after all. He could be beaten, but not broken. Just this once, she didn't inch away. Didn't put her hood up and turn her shoulder. Didn't protect bystanders or herself. His fingertips brushed her chin, trailed up her left cheek. A tingle trailed after his touch, and she humored herself for that fraction of a second that the feeling came from the shock of human contact on her skin, from the surprisingly gentle movement of a seductive hand against her face, inviting her to lean in for more. She could turn her face, brush along his palm, and reach for him. Overcoming a lifetime of instinct to keep her distance would suddenly be very easy. Ray must have also indulged a moment of wishful thinking because he grew bolder, pressing his hand to her face instead of just testing, taking another step in like he might actually kiss her. But that pleasant, warm tingle wasn't the thrill of flirting or nascent foreplay. It was energy. Life force sparking between them, power from Ray's hand flowing into her skin, flooding her nerve endings, pouring through her and making her blood feel molten. Ray hissed in pain, shuddered, and his eyes rolled. He fell back in a dead faint. Instead of lunging forward to catch him as any normal person would have done, Joanne wrapped her cloak around her and stepped back, insulating her power, pulling it close in, forcing her breathing to stay calm, even as her heart pounded. She kept control of herself, as she'd practiced doing her whole life. Ray hit the ground, cracked his head on the pavement, lay there a moment, still. Then, letting out a groan, he put a hand to his head. So, not dead. She was relieved.
"You got a punch like a Mack truck, you know that?"
he muttered. He was one of the tough aces, one of the ones who could take a lot of damage. For just a moment there, she thought that maybe, just maybe. But no. And that was okay. It had to be okay. "You knew the risks," she said to Ray, her smile lopsided.
"Nothing ventured,"
he muttered back, gasping for breath while pretending not to.
"I'd ask for a hand up, but no.
No offense." He hauled himself to his feet, creaking like an old man.
"We should get back to the embassy," she said. "Make sure the drunk delegates get back to the hotel, okay?" "I think I'd rather have you knock me out cold again."
Joanne was calm enough she could laugh at that. The WHO tour was scheduled to leave for Krakow the next afternoon, but Joanne was able to arrange a meeting between Kramer and Katrina for that morning in a coffee shop halfway between the hotel and the old town. They wouldn't draw so much attention, and they would have some privacy. Kramer was already seated at a table with Joanne when Katrina came in, looking bleary-eyed, because of course she did.
Her group had probably stayed up all night partying after their successful redecoration of Wenceslas Square. The police had cleaned up the square quickly, but not before pictures of it ended up in the papers that morning. The international press had even picked up the story. Maybe Katrina was right. Maybe protests like that, enough of them, over time, could work. Kramer stood, adjusting her sleeves nervously as if she was meeting her own daughter. Katrina saw them, sigh, and walked over. Kramer held out her hand. Katrina, dear, I don't know if you remember me. I do, Mrs. Kramer. It's good to see you, Katrina said and dutifully shook the woman's hand. The polite daughter of a wealthy family coming to the fore. The facade seemed wrong on her, after getting to know the bright-eyed artist. They sat, and Katrina put her arm with its tangle of snakes right on the table. Kramer stared a moment, blanching a bit. But to her credit, she recovered quickly and turned earnest. Kramer said, I have to confess, I'm very disappointed in your parents. But you'll still take their contributions, I'm sure. And you'll still draw on your trust fund. This isn't about money. Not for me. I just want you to know, you have friends. I know that you can't ever go to them for help, but I want you to know you're not alone. I know I'm not, ma'am. Thank you. And when you decide you're ready to come home, I'm sure I'll be able to buy a plane ticket like everyone else, Katrina said. Joanne hid a smile behind her hand. Katrina let the congresswoman buy her a coffee, and they made awkward small talk for half an hour before Kramer declared she needed to get back to the hotel to rejoin the rest of the delegates for the trip to the airport. Joanne managed to get a few minutes alone with Katrina as she walked the young woman out of the cafe. She's just like my parents, Katrina explained. I mean, not just like. She at least seems to have some sense of common decency. But my parents want me to think this is the end of the world, that it'll ruin my life. She held up her arm, and the snakes writhed, angry and rippling. But I can still paint. I can still draw. I can still see the world and find a boyfriend. I still have a life, a good life. Can't they see that? The rest of us see it, Joanne said. Because the question didn't seem rhetorical. Katrina needed an answer. Validation. But Joanne had to pause and turn the question back on herself. She could still have a good life. She'd built herself a good life, damn it. Here she was, traveling the world, which so many people dreamed of and never got to do. She had friends. She had purpose. And maybe, someday, somewhere, she'd meet an ace with the exact power to balance hers. Maybe someone who could produce endless fountains of energy out of nothing. And maybe he'd also be smart, handsome, witty, kind. Didn't hurt to dream, did it? Take care of yourself, Katrina. Joanne said goodbye to the young woman before walking Representative Kramer back to the hotel.
From the Journal of Xavier Desmond. April 10th, Stockholm. Very tired. I fear my doctor was correct. This trip may have been a drastic mistake insofar as my health is concerned. I feel I held up remarkably well during the first few months when everything was fresh and new and exciting. But during this last month, a cumulative exhaustion has set in. And the day-to-day grind has become almost unbearable. The flights, the dinners, the endless receiving lines, the visits to hospitals and Joker ghettos and research institutions. It's all threatening to become one great blur of dignitaries and airports and translators and buses and hotel dining rooms. I'm not keeping my food down well. And I know I've lost weight. The cancer? The strain of travel, my age, who can say? All of these, I suspect. Fortunately, the trip is almost over now. We're scheduled to return to Tomlin on April 29th, and only a handful of stops remain. I confess that I'm looking forward to my return home, and I do not think I'm alone in that. We are all tired. Still, despite the toll it has taken, I would not have forfeited this trip for anything. I have seen the pyramids and the Great Wall, walked the streets of Rio and Marrakesh and Moscow, and soon I will add Rome and Paris and London to that list. I have seen and experienced the stuff of dreams, nightmares, and I have learned much, I think. I can only pray that I survive long enough to use some of that knowledge. Sweden is a bracing change from the Soviet Union and the other Warsaw Pact nations we have visited. I have no strong feelings about socialism one way or the other, but grew very weary of the model joker medical hostels we were constantly being shown, and the model jokers who occupied them. Socialist medicine and socialist science would undoubtedly conquer the wild card, and great strides were already being made, we were repeatedly told. But even if one credits these claims, the price is a lifetime of treatment for the handful of jokers the Soviets admit to having. Billy Ray insists that the Russians actually have thousands of jokers locked away safely out of sight in huge gray joker warehouses, nominally hospitals, but actually prisons in all but name, staffed by a lot of guards and precious few doctors and nurses. Ray also says there are a dozen Soviet aces, all of them secretly employed by the government, the military, the police, or the party. If these things exist, the Soviet Union denies all such allegations, of course. We got nowhere close to any of them, with Intourist and the KGB carefully managing every aspect of our visit, despite the government's assurance to the United Nations that this UN-sanctioned tour would receive every cooperation. To say that Dr. Tachyon did not get along well with his socialist colleagues would be a considerable understatement. His disdain for Soviet medicine is exceeded only by Hiram's disdain for Soviet cooking. Both of them do seem to approve of Soviet vodka, however, and have consumed a great deal of it. There was an amusing little debate in the Winter Palace when one of our hosts explained the dialectic of history to Dr. Tachyon, telling him feudalism must inevitably give way to capitalism, and capitalism to socialism as a civilization matures. Tachyon listened with remarkable politeness and then said, "My dear man, there are two great star-faring civilizations in this small sector of the galaxy. My own people, by your lights, must be considered feudal, and the network is a form of capitalism more rapacious and virulent than anything you've ever dreamed of. Neither of us shows any signs of maturing into socialism, thank you." Then he paused for a moment and added, "Although, if you think of it in the right light, perhaps the swarm might be considered communist, though scarcely civilized." It was a clever little speech, I must admit, although I think it might have impressed the Soviets more if Tachyon had not been dressed in full Cossack regalia when he delivered it. Where does he get these outfits? Of the other Warsaw Bloc nations, there is little to report. Yugoslavia was the warmest, Poland the grimmest, Czechoslovakia seemed the most like home. Downs wrote a marvelously engrossing piece for Aces, speculating that the widespread peasant accounts of active contemporary vampires in Hungary and Romania were actually manifestations of the wild card. It was his best work, actually. Some really excellent writing. And all the more remarkable when you consider that he based the whole thing on a 5-minute conversation with a pastry chef in Budapest. We found a small Joker ghetto in Warsaw, and a widespread belief in a hidden solidarity ace who will shortly come forth to lead that outlawed trade union to victory. He did not, alas, come forth during our 2 days in Poland. Senator Hartman, with greatest difficulty, managed to arrange a meeting with Lech Walesa. And I believe that the AP news photo of their meeting has enhanced his stature back home. Hiram left us briefly in Hungary. Another emergency back in New York, he said, and returned just as we arrived in Sweden, in somewhat better spirits. Stockholm is a most congenial city, after many of the places we have been. Virtually all the Swedes we have met speak excellent English. We are free to come and go as we please, within the confines of our merciless schedule, of course. And the king was most gracious to all of us. Jokers are quite rare here this far north. But he greeted us with complete equanimity, as if he'd been hosting jokers all of his life. Still, as enjoyable as our brief visit has been, there is only one incident that is worth recording for posterity. I believe we've unearthed something that will make the historians around the world sit up and take notice, a hitherto unknown fact that puts much of recent Middle Eastern history into a new and startling perspective. It occurred during an otherwise unremarkable afternoon a number of the delegates spent with the Nobel trustees. I believe it was Senator Hartman they actually wanted to meet. Although it ended in violence, his attempt to meet and negotiate with the Nur al-Allah in Syria is correctly seen here for what it was, a sincere and courageous effort on behalf of peace and understanding, and one that makes him, to my mind, a legitimate candidate for next year's Nobel Peace Prize. At any rate, several of the other delegates accompanied Greg to the meeting, which was cordial but hardly stimulating. One of our hosts, it turned out, had been a secretary to Count Foka Bernadotte when he negotiated the Peace of Jerusalem, and sadly enough had also been with Bernadotte when he was gunned down by Israeli terrorists 2 years later. He told us several fascinating anecdotes about Bernadotte, for whom he clearly had great admiration, and also showed us some of his personal memorabilia of those difficult negotiations. Among the notes, journals, and from drafts, was a photo book. I gave the book a cursory glance and then passed it on, as did most of my companions. Dr. Tachyon, who was seated beside me on the couch, seemed bored by the proceedings and leafed through the photographs with rather more care. Bernadotte figured in most of them, of course, standing with his negotiating team, talking with David Ben-Gurion in one photo and King Faisal in the next. The various aides, including our host, were seen in less formal poses, shaking hands with Israeli soldiers, eating with a tentful of Bedouin, and so on, the usual sort of thing. By far the single most arresting picture showed Bernadotte surrounded by the Nasser, the Port Said aces, who so dramatically reversed the title of battle when they joined with Jordan's crack Arab Legion. Koff sits beside Bernadotte in the center of the photograph, all in black, looking like death incarnate, surrounded by the younger aces. Ironically enough, of all the faces in that photo, only three are still alive, the ageless Koff among them. Even an undeclared war takes its toll. That was not the photograph that caught Tachyon's attention, however. It was another, a very informal snapshot, showing Bernadotte and various members of his team in some hotel room, the table in front of them littered with papers. In one corner of the photograph was a young man I had not noticed in any of the other pictures, slim, dark-haired, with a certain intense look around the eyes and a rather ingratiating grin. He was pouring a cup of coffee, all very innocent. But Tachyon stared at the photograph for a long time and then called our host over and said to him privately, "Forgive me if I tax your memory, but I would be very interested to know if you remember this man." He pointed him out. "Was he a member of your team?" Our Swedish friend leaned over, studied the photograph, and chuckled. "Oh, him," he said in excellent English. "He was. What is the slang word you use for a boy who runs errands and does odd jobs? An animal of some sort?" "A gopher," I supplied. "Yes, he was a gopher, as you put it. Actually, a young journalism student. Joshua, that was his name. Joshua something. He said he wanted to observe the negotiations from within so he could write about them afterward. Bernadotte thought the idea was ridiculous when he was first put to him, rejected it out of hand, in fact. But the young man was persistent. He finally managed to corner the Count and put his case to him personally, and somehow he talked him around. So he was not officially a member of the team, but he was with us constantly from that point through the end. He was not a very efficient gopher, as I recall, but he was such a pleasant young man that everyone liked him regardless. I don't believe he ever wrote his article." "No," Tachyon said. "He wouldn't have. He was a chess player, not a writer." Our host lit up with remembrance. "Why, yes, he played incessantly, now that I recall. He was quite good. Do you know him, Dr. Tachyon? I've often wondered whatever became of him." "So have I," Tachyon replied very simply and very sadly. Then he closed the book and changed the topic. I have known Dr. Tachyon for more years than I care to contemplate. That evening, spurred by my own curiosity, I managed to seat myself near Jack Braun and ask him a few innocent questions while we ate. I'm certain that he suspected nothing, but he was willing enough to reminisce about the four aces, the things they did and tried to do, the places they went, and, more importantly, the places they did not go, at least not officially. Afterward, I found Dr. Tachyon drinking alone in his room. He invited me in, and it was clear that he was feeling quite morose, lost in his damnable memories. He lives as much in the past as any man I have ever known. I asked him who the young man in the photograph had been. "No," Tachyon said. "Just the boy I used to play chess with." I'm not sure why he felt he had to lie to me. His name was not Joshua, I told him, and he seemed startled. I wonder, does he think my deformity affects my mind, my memory? His name was David, and he was not supposed to be there. The four aces were never officially involved in the Mideast, and Jack Braun says that by late 1948, the members of the group had gone their own ways. Braun was making movies. "Bad movies," Tachyon said with a certain venom. "Meanwhile," I said, "the envoy was making peace." "He was gone for 2 months. He told Blythe and me that he was going on a vacation, I remember. It never occurred to me that he was involved." No more has it ever occurred to the rest of the world. Though perhaps it should have. David Harstein was not particularly religious, from what little I know of him. But he was Jewish, And when the Port Said aces and the Arab armies threatened the very existence of this new state of Israel, he acted all on his own. His was a power for peace, not war. Not fear or sandstorms or lightning from a clear sky, but pheromones that made people like him and want desperately to please him and agree with him, that made the mere presence of the ace called envoy a virtual guarantee of successful negotiation. But those who knew who and what he was showed a distressing tendency to repudiate their agreements once Harstein and his pheromones had left their presence. He must have pondered that, and, with the stakes so high, he must have decided to find out what might happen if his role in the process was carefully kept secret. The peace of Jerusalem was his answer. I wonder if even Volker Bernadotte knew who his gopher really was. I wonder where Harstein is now, and what he thinks of the peace that he so carefully and secretly wrought. And I find myself reflecting on what the Black Dog said in Jerusalem. What would it do to the fragile peace of Jerusalem if its origins were revealed to the world? The more I reflect on that, the more certain I grow that I ought to tear these pages from my journal before I offer it for publication. If no one gets Dr. Tachyon drunk, perhaps this secret can even be kept. Did he ever do it again, I wonder? After HUAC, after prison and disgrace, and his celebrated conscription, an equally celebrated disappearance, did the envoy ever sit in on any other negotiations, with the world's being none the wiser? I wonder if we'll ever know. I think it unlikely, and wish it were not. From what I've seen on this tour in Guatemala and South Africa, in Ethiopia and Syria and Jerusalem, in India and Indonesia and Poland, the world today needs the envoy more than ever.
Puppets by Victor W. Milan. Read for you by Clancy Brown, Adrian Paul, Emily Rankin, Raphael Sabarge, and P.J. Oakland. Mac Heath had a jackknife, so the song went. Mackie Messer had something better, and it was ever so much easier to keep out of sight. Mackie blew into the camera store on a breath of cool air and diesel farts from the Kurfürstendamm. He left off whistling his song, let the door hiss to behind him, and stood with his fists rammed down in his jacket pockets to catch a look around. Light slam-danced on countertops, the curves of cameras, black and glassy-eyed. He felt the humming of the lights down beneath his skin. This place got on his tits. It was so clean and antiseptic, it made him think of a doctor's office. He hated doctors. Always had. Since the doctors the Hamburg court sent him to see when he was 13 said he was crazy, and penned him up in a Land juvie/psych ward, and the orderly there was a pig from the Tirol, who was always breathing booze and garlic over him and trying to get him to jerk him off. And then he'd turned over his ace and walked on out of there. And the thought brought a smile and a rush of confidence. On a stool by the display counter lay a Berliner Zeitung, folded to the headline, Wildcard tour to visit Wall today. He smiled. Thin. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Then Dieter came in from the back and saw him. He stopped dead and put this foolish smile on his face.
Mackie! Hey! It's a little early, isn't it?
He had a narrow, pale head, with dark hair slicked back in a smear of oil. His suit was blue, and ran to too much padding in the shoulders. His tie was thin and iridescent. His lower lip quivered just a little. Mackie was standing still. His eyes were the eyes of a shark, cold and gray, and expressionless as steel marbles.
"I was just, you know, putting in my appearance here," Dieter said.
A hand jittered around at the cameras and the neon tubing, and the sprawling shiny posters showing the tanned women with shades and too many teeth. The hand glowed the white of a dead fish's belly in the artificial light.
"Appearances are important, you know. Got to lull the suspicions of the bourgeoisie. Especially today."
He tried to keep his eyes off Mackie, but they just kept rolling back to him, as if the whole room slanted downward to where he stood. The ace didn't look like much. He was maybe 17, looked younger, except for his skin. That had a dryness to it, a touch of parchment age. He wasn't much more than 170 centimeters tall, even skinnier than Dieter, and his body kind of twisted. He wore a black leather jacket that Dieter knew was scuffed to gray along the canted line of his shoulders, jeans that were tired before he fished them out of a trash can in Dahlem, a pair of Dutch clogs. A brush of straw hair stuck up at random above the drawn-out face of an El Greco martyr, oddly vulnerable. His lips were thin and mobile.
"So you stepped up the timetable. Came for me early," Dieter said lamely.
Mackie flashed forward, wrapped his hand in shiny tie, hauled Dieter toward him.
"Maybe it's too late for you, comrade. Maybe, maybe."
The camera salesman had a curious glossy pale complexion, like laminated paper. Now his skin turned the color of a sheet of the Zeitung after it had spent the night blowing along a Budapesta Strasse curb. He'd seen what that hand could do.
Mackie,
he stammered, clutching at the reed-thin arm. He collected himself then, patted Mackie affectionately on a leather sleeve.
"Hey! Hey now, brother! What's the matter? You tried to sell us, motherfucker!"
Mackie screamed, spraying spittle all over Dieter's aftershave. Dieter jerked back. His arm twitched with the lust to wipe his cheek.
"What the fuck are you talking about, Mackie? I'd never try. Kelly! That Australian bitch! Wolf thought she was acting funny and leaned on her."
A grin winched its way across Mackie's face.
"She's never going to the fucking Bundeskriminalamt now, man. She's Speck. Lunch meat."
Dieter's tongue flicked bluish lips.
"Listen, you've got it wrong. She was nothing to me. I knew she was just a groupie all along."
His eyes informed on him, sliding ever so slightly to the right. His hand suddenly flared up from below the register with a black snub revolver in it. Mackie's left hand whirred down, vibrating like the blade of a jigsaw. It sheared through the pistol's top strap, through the cylinder and cartridges, and slashed open the trigger guard a piece of a centimeter in front of Dieter's forefinger. The finger clenched spastically. The hammer came back and clicked too, and the rear half of the cylinder, its fresh-cut face glistening like silver, fell forward onto the countertop. Glass cracked. Mackie grabbed Dieter by the face and hauled him forward. The camera salesman put down his hands to steady himself, shrieked as they went through the countertops. The broken glass raked him like talons, slashing through blue coat sleeve and blue French shirt and fish belly skin beneath. His blood streamed over Zeiss lenses and Japanese import cameras that were making inroads in the Federal Republic despite chauvinism and high tariffs, ruining their finish.
"Viva comrades!"
Why? Why?
Mackie's whole skinny body was shaking in hurt fury. Tears filled his eyes. His hands began to vibrate of their own accord. Dieter squealed as he felt them rasping at the post-shave stubble he could never get rid of, the only flaw in his neo-sleek grooming.
I don't know what you're talking about, he screamed. I never meant to do it. I was playing her along. Liar!
Mackie yelled. The anger jolted through him like a blast from the third rail, and his hands were buzzing, buzzing, and Dieter was flopping and howling as the flesh began to come off his cheeks, and Mackie gripped him harder, hands on cheekbones, and the rising vibration of his hands was transmitted through bone to the wet mass of Dieter's brain. And the camera salesman's eyes rolled, and his tongue came out, and the violent agitation flash-boiled the fluids in his skull. And his head exploded. Mackie dropped him, danced back howling like a man on fire, swiping at the clotted stuff that filled his eyes and clung to his cheeks and hair. When he could see, he went around the counter and kicked the quivering body. It slid onto the cuffed linoleum floor. The cash register was flashing orange error condition warnings. The display case swam with blood, and there were lumps of greasy yellow-gray brains all over everything. Mackie dabbed at his jacket and screamed again when his hands came away slimy.
You bastard!
He kicked the headless corpse again.
You got this shit all over me, you asshole! 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 Asshole!
He hunkered down, pulled up the tail of Dieter's suit coat, and wiped the worst lumps off his face and hands and leather jacket.
Oh, it's Dieter! Dieter!
He sobbed.
I wanted to talk to you! Stupid son of a bitch!
He picked up a cold hand, kissed it, tenderly rested it on a spattered lapel. Then he went back to the John to wash down as best he could. When he came out, anger and sorrow both had faded, leaving a strange elation. Dieter had tried to fuck with the faction, and he'd paid the price. And what the hell did it matter if Mackie hadn't been able to find out why? It didn't matter. Nothing mattered. Mackie was an ace. He was Mackheath, made flesh, invulnerable. And in a couple of hours, he was going to show the cocksuckers. The glass doors up front opened, and somebody came in. Laughing to himself, Mackie changed phase and walked through the wall.
Rain jittered briefly on the roof of the Mercedes limo. We'll be meeting a number of influential people at this luncheon, Senator, said the young black man with the long, narrow face and earnest expression riding with his back to the driver. It's going to be an excellent opportunity to show your commitment to brotherhood and tolerance, not just for jokers, but for members of oppressed groups of all persuasions. Really excellent. I'm sure it will, Ronnie. Chin on hand, Hartman let his eyes slide away from his junior aide and out the condensation-fogged window. Blocks of apartments rolled by, tan and anonymous. This close to the wall, Berlin seemed always to be holding its breath. Aid at Amitié has an international reputation for its work to promote tolerance, Ronnie said. The head of the Berlin chapter, Herr Prahler, recently received recognition for his efforts to improve public acceptance of the Turkish guest workers, though I understand he's a rather, controversial personality. Communist bastard, grunted Mueller from the front seat. He was a strapping blonde kid plainclothesman with big hands and prominent ears that made him resemble a hound pup. He spoke English out of deference to the American senator, though between a grandmother from the old country and a few college courses, Hartman knew enough German to get by. Herr Prahler's active in Rote Hilfe, Red Help, explained Moeller's opposite number, Bloom, from the back seat. He was sitting on the other side of Mordecai Jones, who sometimes, and with poor grace, responded to the nickname Harlem Hammer. Jones was concentrating on the New York Times crossword puzzle and acting as if no one else was there. He's a lawyer, you know. Been defending radicals since Andy Bader's salad days. Helping damn terrorists get off with a slap on the wrist, you mean? Bloom laughed and shrugged. He was leaner and darker than Mueller, and he wore his curly black hair shaggy enough to push even the notoriously liberal standards of the Berlin Schutzpolizei. But his brown artist's eyes were watchful, and the way he held himself suggested he knew how to use the tiny machine pistol in the shoulder holster that bulked out his gray suit coat in a way not even meticulous German tailoring could altogether conceal. Even radicals have a right to representation. This is Berlin, Mensch. We take freedom seriously here, if only to set an example for our neighbors, yeah? Mueller made a skeptical sound low in his throat. Ronnie fidgeted on the seat and checked his watch. Maybe we could go a little faster. We don't want to be late. The driver flashed a grin over his shoulder. He resembled a smaller edition of Tom Cruise, though more ferret-faced. He couldn't have been as young as he looked. The streets are narrow here. We don't want to have an accident. Then we'd be even later. Hartman's aide set his mouth and fussed with papers in the briefcase open on his lap. Hartman slid another glance toward the bulk of the hammer who was still stolidly ignoring everybody. Puppet Man was amazingly quiescent, given his gut dread of aces. Maybe he was even feeling a certain thrill at Jones's proximity. Not that Jones looked like an ace. He appeared to be a normal black man in his mid to late 30s, bearded, balding, solidly built, looking none too well at ease, knotted into coat and tie. Nothing out of the ordinary. As a matter of fact, he weighed 470 pounds and had to sit in the center of the Merc so it wouldn't list. He might be the strongest man in the world, stronger than Golden Boy, perhaps, but he refused to engage in any kind of competition to settle the issue. He disliked being an ace, disliked being a celebrity, disliked politicians, and thought the entire tour was a waste of time. Hartman had the impression he'd only agreed to come along because his neighbors in Harlem got such a kick out of his being in the spotlight, and he hated to let them down. Jones was a token. He knew it. He resented it. That was one reason Hartman had goaded him into coming to the aid at Amitié luncheon. That, and the fact that, for all their pious pretensions of brotherhood, most Germans didn't like blacks and were uncomfortable around them. They pretended, but that wasn't the sort of thing you could hide from Puppet Man. He found the hammer's peak and the discomfort of their hosts amusing, almost worthwhile to take Jones on as a puppet, but not quite. The hammer was known primarily as a muscle man ace, but the full scope of his powers was a mystery. Any chance of discovery was too much for Puppet Man. Beyond the minor titillations poking everyone off balance provided, Hartman was getting fed up with Billy Ray. Carnifex had fumed and blustered when Hartman ditched him with the rest of the tour back at the wall. Detailed to escort Mrs. Hartman and the senator's two senior aides back to the hotel, but he couldn't say much without offending their hosts, whose security men were on the job. And anyway, with the hammer along, what could possibly happen?
Scheiße, the driver said.
He had turned the corner to find a gray and white telephone van parked, blocking the street next to an open manhole. He braked to a halt.
Idiots, said Mueller. They're not supposed to do that.
He unlocked the passenger door. Beside Hartman, Bloom flicked his eyes to the rearview mirror. Uh-oh, he said softly. His right hand went inside his coat. Hartman craned his neck. A second van had cranked itself across the street not 30 feet behind them. Its doors were open, spilling people onto pavement wet from the rain spasm. They held weapons. Bloom shouted a warning to his partner. A figure loomed up beside the car. A terrible metal screeching filled the limousine. Hartman's breath turned solid in his throat as a hand cut through the roof of the car in a shower of sparks. Mueller winced away. He drew his MP5K from its shoulder holster, pressed it to the window, and fired a burst. Glass exploded outward. The hand snapped back.
Jesus Christ! Mueller shouted. The bullets went right through him!
He threw open the door. A man with a ski mask over his face fired an assault rifle from the rear of the telephone van. The noise rattled the car's thick windows on and on. It sounded oddly remote. The windshield starred. The man who cut through the roof screamed and went down. Mueller danced back 3 steps, fell against the Mercedes fender, collapsed to the pavement, squirming and screaming. His coat fell open. Scarlet spiders clung to his chest. The assault rifle ran dry. The sudden silence was thunderous. Puppet Man's fingers were clenched on the padded handle of the door as Mueller's mind scream jolted into him like speed hitting the main line. He gasped at the hot, mad pleasure of it, at the cold rush of his own fear. "Hande hoch!" shouted a figure beside the van that had boxed them from behind. "Hands up!" Mordecai Jones put a big hand on Hartman's shoulder and pushed him to the floor. He clambered over him, careful not to squash him, put his weight against the door. Metal wailed, and it came away with him as Bloom, more conventional, pulled the lever on his own door to disengage the latching mechanism, twisted and shouldered it open. He brought his MP5K up with his left hand clutching the vestigial foregrip, aimed the stubby machine pistol back around the frame as Hartman yelled, "Don't shoot!" The hammer was racing toward the telephone van. The terrorist who'd shot Mueller pointed his weapon at him, pumped his finger on the empty weapon's trigger in a comic pantomime of panic. Jones backhanded him gently. He sailed backward to rebound off the front of a building and land in a heap on the sidewalk. The moment hung in air like a suspended cord. Jones squatted, got his hands under the phone van's frame. He strained, straightened. The van came up with him. Its driver screamed in terror. The hammer shifted his grip and pressed the vehicle over his head as if it were a not particularly heavy barbell. A burst of gunfire stuttered from the second van. Bullets shredded open the back of Jones's coat. He teetered, almost lost it, swung in a ponderous circle with the van still balanced above his head. Then several terrorists fired at once. He grimaced and fell backward. The van landed right on top of him. The limo driver had his door open and a little black P7 in his hand. As the hammer fell, Bloom blazed a quick burst at the van behind. A man ducked back as 9mm bullets punched neat holes in thin metal. A joker, Hartman realized. What the hell's going on here? He ducked his head below window level and grabbed at Bloom's coattail. He felt the vehicle shudder on its suspension as bullets struck it. The driver gasped and slumped out of the car. Hartman heard somebody yelling in English to cease fire. He shouted for Bloom to quit shooting. The policeman turned toward him. "Yes, sir," he said. Then a burst punched through his open door and shook the glass in the window and threw him against the senator. Ronnie was plastered against the back of the driver's seat. "Oh, God," he moaned. "Oh, dear God." He jumped out the door the hammer had torn from its hinges and ran, with papers scattered from his briefcase swooping around him like seagulls. The terrorist Mordecai Jones had brushed aside had recovered enough to come to one knee and stuff another magazine into his AKM. He brought it to his shoulder and emptied it at the senator's aid in a juddering burst. A scream and mist of blood sprayed from Ronnie's mouth. He fell and skidded. Hartman huddled on the floor in fugue, half terrified, half orgasmic. Bloom was dying, holding onto Hartman's arm, the holes in his chest sucking like lamia mouths, his life force surging into the senator like a rhythmic surf. "I'm hurt," the policeman said. "Oh, Mama, Mama, please." He died. Hartman jerked like a harpoon seal as the last of the man's life gushed into him. Out by the street, Hartman's young aide was dragging himself along with his arms, glasses askew, leaving a snail trail of blood on the sidewalk. The slightly built terrorist who had shot him ambled up, stuffing a third magazine into his weapon. He positioned himself in front of the wounded man. Ronnie blinked up at him. Disjointed, Hartman remembered he was desperately nearsighted, virtually blind without his glasses. "Please," Ronnie said. Blood rolled from his mouth. "Please."
"Hafa neger kus,"
the terrorist said, and fired a single shot into his forehead. "Dear God," Hartman said. A shadow fell across him, heavy as a corpse. He looked up with inhuman eyes at a figure black against the gray cloud sky beyond. A hand gripped him by the arm. Electricity blasted through him, and consciousness exploded in ozone convulsion.
Substantial again. Mackie bounced to his feet and tore off his ski mask.
"You shot at me! You could have killed me!"
he shrieked at Annika. His face was almost black. She laughed at him. The world seemed to come on to Mackie in Kodachrome colors. He started for her, hand beginning to buzz, when a commotion behind him brought his head around. The dwarf had grabbed Ulrich's rifle by the still-hot muzzle brake and spun him round, echoing Mackie's theme, with variations.
"You stupid bastard! You could have killed him!" he screamed. "You could have offed the fucking senator!"
Ulrich had fired the final burst that downed the cop in the back of the limousine. Weightlifter though he was only just hanging on to his piece against the dwarf's surprising strength. The two were orbiting each other out there on the street, spitting at one another like cats. Mackie had to laugh. Then Molnia was beside him, touching his shoulder with a gloved hand.
"Let it go. We have to move quickly."
Mackie arched like a cat to meet the touch. Comrade Molnia was worried he was still mad at Annika for shooting at him and then laughing about it. But that was forgotten. Annika was laughing, too, over the body of the man she'd just finished off, and Mackie had to laugh with her.
"A negakus," he said. "You said, did he want a negakus? Ha ha, that was pretty good."
It meant Negro kiss, a small chocolate-covered cake. It was especially funny, since they'd told him Negro kisses were a trademark of the group from back in the old days, back when all of them but Wolf were kids. It was nervous laughter. Relieved laughter. He'd thought he'd lost it when the pig shot at him. He'd just seen the gun come up in time to phase out, and the anger burned black within him. The desire to make his hand vibrate till it was hard as a knife blade and drive it into that fucking cop. To make sure he felt the buzz. To feel the hot rush of blood along his arm and spraying in his face. But the bastard was dead. It was too late now. He'd worried again when the black man picked up the van, but then Comrade Ulrich shot him. He was strong, but he wasn't immune to bullets. Mackie liked Comrade Ulrich. He was so self-assured, so handsome and muscular. Women liked him. Annika could hardly keep her hands off him. Mackie might have envied him, if he hadn't been an ace. Mackie didn't have a gun himself. He hated them. And anyway, he didn't need a weapon. There wasn't any weapon better than his own body. The American joker called Scrape was fumbling Hartman's limp body out of the limousine.
"Is he dead?"
Mackie called in German, caught up by sudden panic. The dwarf let go of Ulrich's rifle and stared wildly at the car. Ulrich almost fell over. Scrape looked up at Mackie, face frozen into immobility by its exoskeleton, but his lack of understanding clear from the tilt of his head. Mackie repeated the question in the halting English he'd learned from his mother before the worthless bitch had died and deserted him. Comrade Molnia pulled his other glove back on. He wore no mask, and now Mackie noticed he looked a little green at the sight of the blood spilled all over the street.
"He's fine," he replied for Scrape. "I just shocked him unconscious. Come now, we must hurry."
Mackie grinned and bobbed his head. He felt a certain satisfaction at Molnia's squeamishness, even though he wanted to please the Russian ace almost as much as he did his own cell leader, Wolf. He went to help Scrape, though he hated being so close to the Joker. He feared he might touch him accidentally. The thought made his flesh crawl. Comrade Wolf stood by with his own unfired Kalashnikov dangling from one huge hand.
"Get him in the van," he ordered. "Him too."
He nodded to Comrade Wilfried, who'd stumbled from the driver's seat of the telephone van and was on his knees pitching breakfast on the wet asphalt. It started to rain again. Broad pools of blood on the pavement began to fray like banners whipped by the wind. In the distance, Sirens commenced their hair-raising chant. They put Hartman into the second van. Scrape got behind the wheel. Molnia slid in beside him. The Joker backed up onto the sidewalk, turned, and drove away. Mackie sat on the wheel well, drumming a heavy metal beat on his thighs.
We did it! We captured him!
He could barely sit still. His penis was stiff inside his jeans. Out the back window, he saw Ulrich spraying letters on a wall in red paint. R.A.F. He laughed again. That would make the bourgeoisie shit their pants, that was for sure. 10 years ago, those initials had been a synonym for terror in the Federal Republic. Now, they would be again. It gave Mackie happy chills to think about it. A Joker wrapped head to toe in a shabby cloak stepped up and sprayed 3 more letters beneath the first, with a hand wrapped in bandages. J.J.S. The other van heeled way over to the side as its wheels rolled over the supine body of the Black American Ace. And they were gone.
With her NEC laptop computer tucked under one arm and a bit of her cheek caught between her small side teeth, Sarah strode across the lobby of the Bristol Hotel Kempinski with briskness that an outside observer would probably have taken for confidence. It was a misapprehension that had served her well in the past. Reflexively, she ducked into the bar of Berlin's most luxurious hotel. The tour proper's long since been mined out, at least of stuff we can print, she thought. But what the heck? She felt heat in her ears at the thought that she was the star of one of the tour's choicer unprintable vignettes. Inside was dark, of course. All bars are the same song. The polished wood and brass and old pliable leather and elephant ears were grace notes to set apart this particular refrain. She tipped her sunglasses up on top of her nearly white hair, drawn back this afternoon in a severe ponytail, and let her eyes adjust. They always adjusted to dark more quickly than light. The bar wasn't crowded. A pair of waiters in arm garters and starched highboy collars worked their way among the tables as if by radar. 3 Japanese businessmen sat at a table chattering and pointing at a newspaper, discussing either the exchange rates or the local tit bars, depending. In the corner, Hiram was talking shop, in French, of course, with the Kempinski's Cordon Bleu, who was shorter than he was, but at least as round. The hotel chef had a tendency to flap his short arms rapidly when he spoke, which made him look like a fat baby bird that wasn't getting the hang of flight. Chrysalis sat at the bar drinking in splendid isolation. There was no Joker chic here. In Germany, Chrysalis found herself discreetly avoided rather than lionized. She caught Sarah's eye and winked. In the poor light, Sarah only knew it because of the way Chrysalis's mascaraed eyelashes tracked across a staring eyeball. She smiled. Professional associates back home, sometime rivals in the bartering of information that was the metagame of Jokertown, they'd grown to be friends on this trip. Sarah had more in common with Deborah Jo than her nominal peers who were along. At least Chrysalis was dressed. She was showing a different face to Europe than she did the country she pretended wasn't her native one. Sometimes Sarah envied her, secretly. People looked at her and saw a Joker, an exotic, alluring and grotesque. But they didn't see her.
Looking for me, little lady?
Sarah started, turned. Jack Braun sat at the end of the bar, hardly 5 feet from her. She hadn't noticed him. She had a tendency to edit him out. The force of him made her uncomfortable. I'm going out, she said. She slapped the computer, a touch harder than necessary, so her fingers stung. Down to the main post office to file my latest material by modem. It's the only place you can get a transatlantic connection that won't scramble all your data.
I'm surprised you're not off pushing cookies with Senator Gregg, he said, eyeing her cantwise from beneath bushy eyebrows.
She felt color come to her cheeks. Senator Hartman attending a banquet may be a hot item for my colleagues with the celebrity-hunting glossies, but it's not exactly hard news, is it, Mr. Braun? It was an open afternoon. There wasn't much hard news here, not the kind to interest readers following the WHO tour. The West German authorities had blandly assured the visitors there was no wildcard problem in their country, and used the tour as a counter in whatever game they were playing with their Siamese twin to the east, that damp, dreary ceremony this morning, for instance. Of course, they were right. Even proportionally, the number of German wildcard victims was minuscule. The most pathetic or unsightly couple of thousand were kept discreetly tucked away in state housing or clinics. Much as they'd sneered at Americans for their treatment of jokers during the 60s and 70s, the Germans were embarrassed by their own.
Depends on what gets said at the banquet, I guess. What's on your schedule after you file your piece, little lady?
He was grinning that B-movie leading man grin at her. Golden highlights glimmered on the planes and contour edges of his face. He was flexing his muscles to bring on the glow that gave him his ace name. Irritation tightened the skin at the outskirts of her eyes. He was either coming on to her for real or teasing her. Either way, she didn't like it. I have work to do, and I could use a little time to catch my breath. Some of us have had a busy time on this tour. Is that really the reason you were relieved when Gregg dropped the hint that it might not be discreet to tag along to the banquet with him? She wondered. She frowned, surprised at the thought, and turned crisply away. Braun's big hand closed on her arm. She gasped and spun back to him, angry and starting to panic. What could she do against a man who could lift a bus? That detached observer inside her, the journalist within, reflected on the irony that Gregg, whom she'd come to hate, yes, obsessively, should be the first man in years whose touch she'd come to welcome. But Jack Braun was frowning past her, into the lobby of the hotel. It was filling up with purposeful, husky young men in suit coats. One of them came into the bar, looked hard at Braun, consulted a piece of paper in his hand.
Herr Braun?
That's me. What can I do you for?
I am with the Berlin Landespolizei. I'm afraid I must ask you not to leave the hotel.
Braun pushed his jaw forward. And why might that be?
Senator Hartman has been kidnapped.
Ellen Hartman shut the door with eggshell care and turned away. The flowered vines fading in the carpet seemed to twine about her ankles as she walked back into the suite and sat down on the bed. Her eyes were dry. They stung, but they were dry. She smiled slightly. It was hard to let her emotions go. She had so much experience controlling her emotions for the cameras. And Gregg. I know what he is. But what he is all I have. She picked up a handkerchief from the bedside table and methodically began to tear it to pieces.